From New England Public Radio in Springfield, Massachusetts, this is NEPR News Now. Stories you really should not miss. I'm Sam Hudzik, the news director at New England Public Radio. Thank you so much for listening. I'm sorry, it's been a few weeks. I took some time off. You know who else already needs a vacation? The brand new head of the Pioneer Valley Transit Authority.
It has been somewhat difficult. I started June 1st, and the first item on the agenda was the PVTA budget deficit.
And we ask her about some major bus service cuts that are on the table. Then a new opera based on a 1960s scandal involving a Smith College professor, gay pornography, and the Scarlet Letter.
1, 2, 3, and... Kinky, stinky, call me freaky, pinkness, somebody's
fun. All right, so you got some singing there. How about some reading? It's our summer fiction series, and we check out Goodnight Ladies, the latest book from Northampton, Massachusetts writer Zane Kotker. Stories of three widows in their early 70s and how they're tackling life and loneliness.
She loves to spend the morning writing her profile for an internet dating company. And then in the afternoon, she answers any people who want to meet with her.
And finally, commentator Grace Lynn, all ready to unload a parental lecture, ended up learning something from her daughter.
There are things that are even more important than being smart, I began. I know, my daughter sighed dramatically, like being brave. Be brave.
When speaking out feels like a responsibility, but is also a privilege. All that just ahead on NEPR News Now. But first, Alex Ciccolo has been in federal custody for more than 2 years. The 24-year-old Adams, Massachusetts man is charged with attempting to commit domestic terrorism. Ciccolo's father is a Boston police captain and was among the first responders at the 2013 Marathon bombings. He was the one who tipped off federal officials his son was becoming obsessed with ISIS. That led to an FBI sting where Ciccolo described to a government informant his plans to explode pressure cooker bombs in a crowded place. After Ciccolo's arrest, his father made a single public statement. His mother kept an even lower profile until recently. New England Public Radio's Jill Kaufman reports.
Alex Ciccolo's parents divorced when he was in grade school. For a while, he lived with his mother on Cape Cod. When he was about 14, he moved closer to Boston, and he lived with his father and stepmother. There were ongoing custody battles, each parent accusing the other of doing a poor job raising their son.
Can I get you anything to drink?
Oh, great, thank you. I'm good. I stopped.
Ciccolo's mother, Shelley McInnes, now lives in Peru, Massachusetts.
I've only been in the Berkshires for a little over 7 years.
She works the overnight shift in a substance abuse clinic. She says her son had his own struggles with addiction, and he did have a problem with anger, McInnes says, but he would not hurt innocent people.
He is very compassionate. He has a deep respect and reverence for all living things. I'm sure some people are out there saying, yeah, right, but he literally would not hurt a fly.
That's what McInnes chooses to believe, she says. And if people want to call her naive or stupid, they still can't take that belief away from her. Yet when Ciccolo was first arrested and he stabbed a nurse at the jail with a pen, that shocked her. She thinks he was disoriented. It was halfway through Ramadan. Ciccolo, who'd converted to Islam a few years ago, was fasting.
And he regrets that. He really has remorse for that.
And that stabbing is the one wrong act McInnes directly acknowledges her son committed. Still, she's relieved he's not on the street.
I'm so glad that he's in prison rather than going out somewhere, if he were planning to do that, I don't know, and getting killed.
McInnes is leaning heavily on her Catholic faith, giving all this trouble up to God, she says. And she's learning about her son's beliefs. Several books on Islam are piled on the table in the compact A-frame house she shares with her second husband. It takes about an hour from here to get to Springfield, and it's a drive they take for almost every one of Ciccolo's appearances in federal court. She visits her son in prison in Rhode Island about twice a month.
We actually get as much time as we want. There are visiting hours. They're different during the weekday and during the weekend.
Since Ciccolo was first arrested on July 4th, 2015, quite a bit has been reported about his early life. According to court records obtained by several media outlets, in his teens, Ciccolo was suspended from school for threatening another student. And then something happened at his father's home in 12th grade. Things got a little physical, McInnes says.
And Alex, you know, in anger, I guess it got pretty aggressive. So then his father decided to call the ambulance, and he was placed in the psychiatric unit.
After Chicolo got out, McGinnis says he refused to take medication. He dropped out of high school, left his father's home, stayed at friends' houses, slept in his car. He was drinking and doing drugs. McGinnis says she knew people who ran a Buddhist peace pagoda in New York State, and her son agreed to go there. He found a mentor and stayed in New York for about a year. And eventually, he made his way to Western Mass, not far from his mother.
Yeah, he worked little odd jobs here and there. I think it was construction or landscaping.
2 weeks before the arrest, McGinnis says her son was reclusive and anxious. He told her everything was fine, but she says he was in despair and angry.
About the situation here in the U.S. and the Middle East and around the world, what was happening to his Muslim brothers and sisters, getting killed, how they're being treated.
According to the U.S. Attorney's Office, Chicolo is a supporter of ISIS. He's accused of attempting to provide the terrorist group with material support. And physical evidence against Chicolo? He received firearms from a person who was cooperating with law enforcement. Several partially constructed Molotov cocktails were found in his apartment. And in recorded conversations, Chicolo describes plans to commit acts of terrorism, including setting off explosives where a large number of people congregate, like college cafeterias. McGinnis won't condemn her son for any of these alleged plans. She has empathy for him. That is being a mother, she says.
Without condoning or justifying it.
Is there any way you think, you know, with the allegations, is there any way you think that he thought that he was doing something good by taking the alleged steps that he took to build a bomb?
Absolutely. There's no doubt in our minds that he felt that it was his duty and in the eyes of God to just to step forward and try to do his part, do something. And I think he didn't know what to do. And I think that if he had some confusion or second thoughts, or I think maybe it got to a point that maybe he didn't know who to go to.
In the past, McGinnis says her son told her everything, but she says she had no clue about any of his alleged plots. And whatever her ex-husband knew, McGinnis says going to the FBI was the wrong way to help their son.
People that you see being executed are criminals.
In a videotaped interview with the FBI in the hours after his arrest, Chicolo is sitting in a cubicle, kitty-corner to a desk. One leg is crossed over the other. When the agent asks Chicolo what he thinks about ISIS, Chicolo doesn't answer at first.
They doing a good thing?
Yeah. Yeah, they are. They're doing a good thing.
Chicolo told the agent ISIS will only kill people who fight them. That claim has been disproved repeatedly by the group's attacks in public spaces, cafes, concerts, offices, places of worship.
I'm happy to answer a few questions, folks.
A couple of weeks after that FBI interview, Chicolo's attorney, David Hoos, stood outside federal court in Springfield.
One of the things that's hard to convey is the depth of this young man's feeling towards his mother and stepdad. And as I said in court, he would not do anything to put them at risk or in danger.
When asked by a reporter how he thought Chicolo's father developed the belief his son was a danger to others, who said this?
We all have children, and our children sometimes fall far from the tree.
And who said he couldn't really elaborate more than that.
Thanks very much, folks.
For New England Public Radio, I'm Jill Kaufman.
The Pioneer Valley Transit Authority has wrapped up a series of public hearings on proposed bus route cuts or service reductions. The PVTA Advisory Board is preparing to announce its final decisions next week after hearing from outraged riders and area colleges. In the middle of all of this, the PVTA's new administrator, Sandra Sheehan. New England Public Radio's Carrie Healy asked Sheehan to describe her first month on the job.
It has been somewhat difficult. I started June 1st, and the first item on the agenda was the PVTA budget deficit. The amount of funding revenues the PVTA is receiving from the various sources were short of what the expenditures are projected for fiscal year 2018. So the PVTA Advisory Board at the May 24th meeting approved the staff going to public hearings to receive comments regarding possible service reductions.
So you're saying this was an inherited situation?
You could say that. You know, PBTA had added a lot of service in 2015 and 2016 with the amount of funding that is received from the different sources, you know, including the fare box and the state contract assistance. There was not sufficient funds to offset the expenditures.
How much did you get briefed on the situation from your predecessor, Mary McGinnis, when you took the job?
Mary and I did not have an opportunity to speak. She was already gone by the time I arrived.
I know that one of the quotes that was attributed to you when you first got the position was that every passenger should experience excellent service when they ride the PVTA.
I did say that.
Is that still what you would say going forward?
It's my intent to make sure that we do everything that is possible to make sure that our passengers receive the best possible service that we can provide. We started with an assumption that all the regional transit authorities in Massachusetts were going to receive $82 million. The budget that was released on Friday by the state lists the regional transit authorities receiving $80 million. So it's even less than what we had anticipated. We went out to public hearing to get comments from the riding public on possible options for service reduction, and we are using their comments to structure the changes that will be forthcoming.
So when the legislature comes through $2 million shorter than was predicted it was going to be, what goes through your mind?
That the $2 million is equivalent to $500,000 for PVTA. The staff and I were very disheartened. We had hoped that we didn't have to make as many changes to the system as we had presented at the public hearings. And what goes through my mind is that we need to work harder to make sure that the stakeholders realize how important public transportation is in the Valley and that we need to work to make sure that the resources are allocated.
I guess one shouldn't really plan on getting more allocations from the state in further budgets because things just don't work out that way. What are some of the things you're going to be focusing on in the future, trying to continue to provide a level of service yet keep fares at a reasonable level?
I'm going to work with the staff to try to determine what savings we could create internally. I'm also going to work with the Massachusetts Association of Regional Transit Authorities and the Pioneer Valley Planning Commission to try to lobby and secure additional resources. We're also going to be looking at transportation management companies and how they can assist us and collaborate on trying to reduce some of the costs of some of the service that we provide, and also technological advances that will be able to create a more seamless transportation network and continue to work with the five colleges, the universities, and all the colleges in the region to make sure that the services that they need, it's provided, and that we work together to make sure that that can be done.
Sandra Sheehan is the PVTA's administrator. In 1960, a famous literature professor at Smith College was arrested for having gay pornographic materials in his Northampton, Massachusetts apartment. Four decades later, that scandal was the basis of a nonfiction book. Now the story is getting a new telling, an operatic one, on the very college campus where the original events took place. New England Public Radio's Karen Brown has this report.
Let's hear just basses and altos.
About a dozen singers, professionals, and students sit in a theater at Amherst College as choral director Gregory Brown leads them through lyrics you don't often hear in opera.
We'll start right on kinky, right on kinky. One, two, three, and...
Kinky, sneaky, kinky, kinky.
They're rehearsing for the fall premiere of a new five-college opera production, The Scarlet Professor, based on Northampton writer Barry Wirth's book of the same name.
And they've magically, I think, transformed this into a kind of a musical theater piece, very, very different from the treatment that I gave it, but in its bones, very close, I think, to the actual truth of the events.
Wirth spent years researching the arrest of Smith College English professor Newton Arvin, who was an expert on Nathaniel Hawthorne's classic The Scarlet Letter. On Labor Day weekend in 1960, Arvin's apartment was raided by the Massachusetts Police Anti-Smut Unit and the local postmaster, who found Beefcake magazines as well as Arvin's sexual journals.
Postal Service.
The incident led to Arvin's public humiliation, his outing of two close colleagues as gay, the end of all their careers at Smith, and eventually, Wirth says, two pivotal court decisions on obscenity and privacy, though too late to help Arvin.
In 1960, there was a purity binge in the United States. McCarthyism as a political movement was spent, but it was picked up with a kind of puritanical zeal by social conservatives, both on a national level and in Massachusetts.
After reading Wirth's book, composer Eric Sawyer of Amherst College and lyricist Harley Erdman of UMass decided to turn it into an opera. Like the book, the opera draws parallels between Arvin's public disgrace and that of Hawthorne's heroine Hester Prynne, who was forced to wear the letter A on her dress for adultery.
And so did I, like Hawthorne before me, build my own dismal chamber.
The opera, which stars tenor Bill Haidt, tells Arvin's story mostly through flashbacks and his imagination after he checks himself into the Northampton State Hospital for psychiatric treatment.
Sees the sickness in our hearts. I can't go forward.
I'm not drawn to art that deals with heroes.
Lyricist Harley Erdman.
I'm actually drawn to art with people who are tormented, conflicted, unsuccessful, failing, and yet come to some kind of transformation where they can take action.
Composer Eric Sawyer admits he needed a little convincing to see Arvin as a compelling central character.
He was a victim in that he was caught up in a witch hunt and was subject to invasion of privacy, which a few years afterwards would have been unconstitutional. But he also was a difficult character to consider completely admirable because he named names. He named the names of his friends.
Now I turn 60. My life is over.
In the end, though, Sawyer connected with the complexity of Arvin's motives.
He had trouble liking himself. And that, I think, is sympathetic. I think it's something a lot of people can relate to.
Newton Arvin was forced to retire from Smith after the scandal, while his colleagues were fired. He wrote one more literary biography before he died, 3 years later, at 63. Opera director Ron Bashford.
Even though this was a very painful period for Arvin and he was outed against his will, ultimately it helped him become a more integrated, honest person. So he didn't live that much longer after all of this happened, but he did somehow manage to become, as he said, a person at peace with himself.
They will never cast their shadows on my way.
The opera will debut, fittingly, on the Smith College campus in September, along with a symposium about the Arvin case. Smith English professor Michael Thurston says no matter how far the college has come since 1960, from gay rights to free speech.
I think we are the product of our histories. There's no getting away from the fact that wherever we are around any issue in 2017, we got there through the actions of past actors, whether they were individuals or institutions.
And putting that history on stage, he says, could help stop it from being repeated. For New England Public Radio, I'm Karen Brown.
In Zane Kotker's latest book, three widows in their early 70s deal with loneliness, fear of death, a condo association, and internet dating. Goodnight Ladies is a novella, 111 pages, and the latest pick in our summer fiction series. I had the privilege of sitting down with Kat Kerr earlier this week and asked her to read a section of her book when the characters are finishing up a monthly book club meeting.
The book discussion ends, and Chessa gets up to separate the logs in her fireplace and calm the flames. They move out of the warmth of the fire and back to the chilly hallway. Upstairs, the dog barks again. Nikki zips her parka and Prue pushes her arms through her coat sleeves. My cousin fell on the ice last week, Prue says. The doctor did a scan of her head. You're fine, he tells her. The scan shows only that your brain has shrunk. Shrunk? My cousin asks. Yes, says the doctor. As we age, the brain pulls inward from its outer limits. Don't worry. It's natural.
So that's Prue.
That's Prue.
We also have Chessa and Nikki. Can you introduce us to these characters?
Yes. Chessa is the rather bold, impulsive one. Nikki is the thoughtful one who worries a lot about climate change and the end of civilization and history in general. And Prue is more of a homebody.
Who's your favorite character?
Well, I identify most with Nikki, but I love reading about Chessa. I also had a friend who had many adventures with internet dating, which Chessa has some exposure to.
Can you talk about some of Chessa's adventures in internet dating?
Well, she loves to spend the morning writing her profile for an internet company. She's really a writer at heart, so she does it in the morning, and then in the afternoon she answers any people who want to meet with her.
She runs across some pretty crude folks online.
Well, what I love about it is the monikers. She has lunch with a... Oh, no, I don't want to give that away. You have to read the book.
You don't want to talk about the lunch.
No.
The lunch is a great part.
Yes. Okay.
The chapters rotate among Chessa, Nikki, and Prue, although the most detailed, and I believe the longest, is about a trip that Nikki takes to southern Spain. And it reads quite differently from some of the other chapters. Why did you put so much focus there?
Well, you're hitting on the secret origin of the book, of the novella. It's made up of 9 stories. 7 of them have been published. So what I was doing here was bringing together stories that went together once I got them pounded into shape, kind of like sculpture, you know.
Were they already overlapping? Were some of the characters introduced, or were they all 3 separate characters that you then brought together?
They were all, the stories existed as stories about an individual generally referred to as she. So I put them together and gave them names and made the personalities out of the existing stories. The story in Spain just was longer.
The characters, to varying degrees, are struggling with their age, with loneliness, fear of death, sadness about a lack of grandkids. You're in your early 80s, so a decade or so older from your characters. Have you experienced these things, and how much of your own life went into these characters?
Well, I should say some of the stories in the novella were published when I was in my late 60s. I have no grandchildren, so that's one thing that I identify with. I struggle with the question of should I sell the old Victorian and move to the community, and I looked into it and decided no, it wasn't for me.
To a retirement community.
The Prue lives in a retirement community.
And that's a big part of her character, that struggle of where to live within that retirement community.
Yes, but I have a friend in the eastern part of the state who does live in a retirement community, and when I was visiting her, she drove me to... Her number had come up. She was now number one in choosing where to live. And she drove me to the condo that she would be going to and looked at it and said, it just has last stop written all over it. So...
Which is
that's a detail in the book. But
you adopted it for Prue. What did your friend think about your adoption of that line?
Oh, she loved it, and she also loves the choice she made.
Zane Kotker's novella is called Goodnight, Ladies. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sam.
And you can find other selections from our summer fiction series at NEPR.net or all summer long, Friday mornings, on New England Public Radio. Commentator and author Grace Lynn recently heard her 4-year-old daughter announce, matter-of-factly, "I know a lot of things. I'm very smart." Lynn agreed, but immediately added a word about the value of hard work and compassion. Her daughter's response was not what Lynn was expecting.
"There are things that are even more important than being smart," I began. "I know," my daughter sighed dramatically, "like being brave. Be brave." I was surprised by her answer, especially as I myself hadn't been feeling very brave lately. I've tried sharing certain thoughts since the election, but every time I've begun, the words stop. As an author, I travel across the United States. I've met so many people. They've all greeted me warmly, and I've never doubted our interactions were genuine. But post-election, I began to mistrust them. Were they fake? Was there a secret belief that I, as an Asian American, shouldn't be here in this country? My mother saw my distress and tried to comfort me. "Don't feel bad," she said. "If we're nice people who contribute something Americans need, we'll be welcomed." She meant well, but this rankled. I am American. I was born and raised here. I can't even speak Chinese. My mother's an American, too. She's lived more years here than in her homeland. Why do we need to prove ourselves in order to be welcomed into our own country? Never before have I been so insecure about my place in the world. An insidious whisper of doubt has been pervading almost every interaction I've had. But then it struck me. This whisper, this doubt, is something I bet Black people in America have lived with their whole lives. Many times I've bemoaned the burden of being an Asian American writer. While other authors are asked about the creative process, I'm usually asked about diversity. I've come to accept that answering those questions is a necessary responsibility. But now I realize it's also a privilege. Because I know people will listen when I say, "I'm angry that I'm no longer sure I'm welcome here." Many others don't have the chance to be heard, which is why I am speaking to you about this now. As my daughter says, be brave.
Grace Lynn is the author and illustrator of more than a dozen children's books, including the National Book Award finalist When the Sea Turned to Silver. She lives in Florence, Massachusetts. This podcast is produced by New England Public Radio, a listener-supported public media company that brings you news and music and all those great Nina Totenberg stories. You can support them all at NEPR.net. Just click the orange donate button at the top of the screen. Thanks so much for listening to NEPR News Now, stories you really should not miss. Be sure to check out some of our other podcasts, including The Shortlist, hosted by Adam Frenier every Friday. That's our week in review. You can find it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you have a moment, please take it and give us a rating. Thanks. Until next time.